Good afternoon, everyone. You can probably do better than that. Good afternoon, everyone. It's that sluggish post-lunch time that we have at the minute. I know that you've already been welcomed to ICC today, and my name's Grumit Meekin. I'm one of the vice principals here at the college, and I'd like to add my welcome to you. It's a pleasure to have Sets meet among us, and particularly on a topic such as this. And I'm slightly biased because this is an issue that's very close to my heart, and something that I enjoy sort of deliberating with, and I'm pleased to be able to join with you for the rest of the conference. We at the college are doing whatever we can to try and help people engage theologically with the issues around us and with contemporary issues. And that's something that we want to promote and we want to encourage here at the college. And having you amongst us is part of how we do that. We're running a number of different things in order to try and encourage people to engage more with contemporary society, whether that be from Monday classes where we've been looking at how can people engage in the workplace, through to the launch of a new master's program that we're launching this September, which is a Master of Theology in Community Learning and Development. So helping churches and those who are Christian agencies, how do they engage with their local communities in developing the local communities, but actually thinking about it from a theological perspective. So we're doing a number of things to try and do that, and so we're more than happy to have you among us today, and certainly we would love to engage with some of you in your time around here for the next 2 days as you join among us to try and find out a bit more about what's making your heart beat at the minute and how can we help empower you and work with you on some of these things. Please feel free to explore the college while you're here. Please feel free to find out a bit more about the college. If you've got some free time, the library is on this floor, and you can go and explore the library and sort of gather as many books as you can and sort of work out what your wish list is for Amazon next time that you're free and what you want to purchase from here. But please use this time as you see fit, and please feel free at home here amongst us. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Graham, and to the others here at the college that have made our visit a very warm one. We welcome you again. I'm Jason Curtis. I'm a committee member here at SETS. And these conferences have always been an encouragement to me and a profound surprise on a lot of levels, just at the high quality and the amount of incredible biblical and theological richness that you find at these SETS conferences. I've never been disappointed with a paper that I've ever heard here. And I hope you'll find that as well. SETS has ambitions to impact the church and academy in Scotland for Christ. And I've noticed on the registration list just before I came in today that there were a lot of people attending and not many members of SETS. If you're a member of SETS, you do receive the bulletin, the Scottish Bulletin of Evangelical Theology, which, again, is a fantastic publication, if we should say so ourselves, right, David? David Reimer's the editor. And the editions this past year have included papers from Herman Bavinck Conference that was in Edinburgh last year, and their outstanding works of scholarship on Bavinck that are relevant for today, and many such articles like them. So I encourage you, if you're interested in becoming a SETS member, you'll get the bulletin with that, you'll get a discounted price to this conference, and you can begin to participate in very specific ways in impacting the church in Scotland. The forms for that, for SETS, are on the table over here. This is just downloaded off the internet. If you'd rather do that, you can do that, or you can pick one of these up, and you can see Alistair Cook, who's down here on the front row, and you can give that membership form to him. It's a great privilege to have Professor David Ferguson with us from New College in Edinburgh. If there's anyone that is competent and skilled to speak to this topic today, it is he. I'm very grateful for him, not only as a friend, but as a Dr. Vater. He was my supervisor at New College when I did my PhD, and I learned much from him. He has published widely. His competencies are in philosophy, theology, historical theology. I was constantly amazed each visit into his office that there wasn't a subject or a person he could not speak to. At least that's the way it seemed to me as a student. And I learned much from him, and I'm very, very, very thankful for him. He recently published a book about 6 or 7 years ago on church, state, and civil society. I encourage you to pick that up. And many of his thoughts, I'm sure, will be included from that book, will be included in our paper today. So, Professor Ferguson, it is our great privilege to have you. We appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to come and speak to us, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Jason. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very pleased to be with you. It's the second happy event with which I've been associated in Glasgow in consecutive days, and it seems appropriate that our chairman today should be a Celtic supporter. I should also say that I'm very grateful to the organisers and also Jamie Grant for being willing to switch the schedule around for today in order to accommodate my own rather chaotic schedule. And I hope coming second won't disrupt the conference in any way. I'm beginning with a somewhat ecumenical slide here. You can probably recognise the scene in the New College courtyard at the bottom of the General Assembly steps, the 39 steps, with His Holiness Pope John Paul II and various Scottish church leaders. In the run-up to the millennium and to the return of the Scottish Parliament in 1999, there was a good deal of coverage of the issue before us this afternoon, namely the extent to which Christianity is a marker of Scottish identity. Since then, however, it seems to me in the 10, 12 years, 13 years since the return of the Parliament, there have been significant discussions of Scottish identity amongst many of our intellectuals and journalists, but very little attention devoted to the place of religion and the church in what it means to be Scottish today. And that lack of attention may tell us something. What I want to do is to throw out a series of reflections and some tentative conclusions this afternoon. These are rather unsystematic in organisation, but I hope that they will stimulate some discussion and conversation afterwards. Here is my menu. I'm going to begin by contrasting the celebration of the Scottish Reformation in 2010 with the celebrations 50 years ago in 1960. I'll then do a little scuba diving around the history of the Scottish churches from the medieval period to the 20th century, followed by some comments on Scotland today and then some tentative concluding reflections. The 450th anniversary of the Scottish Reformation was marked by a number of events in 2010, these taking place at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, several conferences, academic and popular and ecumenical, and also a moving celebration at St. Giles that included representatives of different churches and other faiths. John Miller preached at that service and offered a measured assessment of the Scottish Reformation from the perspective of the Kirk. The singing of the metrical psalms, especially in some of their earliest forms, was amongst the most inspiring feature of those events. The dominant political theme of the anniversary celebrations in 2010, however, was that the Reformation had contributed positively to Scottish society, largely through the educational system that it had spawned. In particular, through the attainment of high adult literacy rates, the educational programme of the Kirk in the 16th century facilitated the great achievements of the Scottish Enlightenment in the 18th. This was generously noted by Tom Devine, writing in Life and Work and in other publications. Devine, of course, is the leading Scottish historian of our day and is someone who describes himself as a cultural Catholic. In much of what was subsequently said by the moderator in 2010 and at the special Sunday evening service of commemoration at the General Assembly, this refrain was heard many times over. The Reformation had given Scotland an educational system of which it could be proud. Building on earlier medieval ideas, it had promoted the work of our schools and universities around the country, advocating a system of comprehensive education. Here, at least, it seemed, was something that everyone could celebrate and of which we need not be embarrassed. This reception of the Reformation in 2010, however, raises several questions for me. Was the Reformation not primarily a theological movement intent on recovering the gospel in the life of the church, partly through a recovery of the Pauline doctrine of justification and a commitment to place the authority of the Bible over and, if necessary, against that of church tradition? The reformers sought the renewal of church and society according to the word of God. They aimed at a godly commonwealth in which church and state were bound together in a close partnership, each fulfilling a divine mandate in its province and both working together to the glory and obedience of God. Education was certainly a feature of this movement, but this was largely directed to the reading of Scripture in the vernacular. It did not aim primarily at secular progress, although it was not antipathetic to this. The reformers of the 16th century indeed would have been deeply disturbed by the theology of the leading moderates in the 18th century, men such as Hutchison, Robertson, Blair, and Reed, all Presbyterian clergy who ranked amongst the leading scholars of the day in almost every field other than theology. So why make so much of this dotted line connecting the Reformation to the Enlightenment? The answer, I think, must be that this narrative enables one to appropriate the gains of the Reformation for a more inclusive vision of Scottish society. Education is an ideal of other churches and other faiths, as well as of secular humanism. Insofar as the Reformation could be enlisted for this cause, it could be celebrated for its civic contribution, even while recognizing its religious dimension. I hope that's not too unfair. Contrast this with the 400th anniversary celebration of the Reformation in 1960. This took place before a decade which witnessed that sudden process of secularization, which in many ways is still with us, at least as far as the decline of the national church is concerned. In 1960, nobody spoke about the Scottish Enlightenment. Why was that? The reason is that the term wasn't invented until the 1970s, a sign that the signification of Scottishness itself is a fluid activity, and that recent constructions of our cultural identity have tended to avoid religion. The 1960 celebrations were impressive in many ways. There was a flurry of popular books based on serious scholarship. These were devoted to studying John Knox, the Reformed churches, and the wider history of the Kirk. The Queen spoke at the General Assembly in 1960, apparently the first monarch to do so since her ancestor James VI, son of Mary, Queen of Scots. She described the Kirk as the national church of Scotland and celebrated its inclusiveness and public contribution. The moderator that year was Principal Burley, Professor of Ecclesiastical History at New College. He gave a closing address to the General Assembly, which still repays study. The reformers, he insists, did not create a new church. Okay, here's Principal Jake Burley at the end of the 1960 General Assembly. The Reformers, he tells us, didn't create a new church. They belonged to the one Catholic Church, which they sought to reform within the realm of Scotland. He says the Reformers aimed at national reformation, which they were persuaded would ensue from a reformation of the Church of Scotland, the Kirk of God within the realm. Church and state must cooperate to make of the nation a Christian nation. It's interesting that he assumes that before 1560 there was already a Scottish church, which in some ways expresses Scottish national identity. The task of the reformers is thus not to create a new church, but to reform the old Scottish church, which had existed for many centuries. At the same time, Burley insisted that the Reformation drew attention to the importance of the local congregation. This was where the marks of the church, preaching, sacramental administration, and godly discipline were most apparent. In 1560, he said, this emphasis laid on the particular kirk was a protest against one of the glaring defects of the church of the day, which treated the local congregation as of little importance by comparison with other more grandiose ecclesiastical institutions. But it was a creative protest, for it claimed for pastoral work among the people the highest priority amongst the church's activities, making it the characteristic and essential activity of the Church of God. This emphasis carried with it an enhancement of the office of the pastor or parish minister and a corresponding raising of the requirements demanded of those who would undertake it. Now, I'll return to this point later because it seems to me to afford a relevant reflection for the presence and mission of the church today in Scotland. In a society in which the kirk has ceased to be the dominant civic institution, the local congregation can still flourish and attest the gospel, even when it expresses the faith of a minority. Other features of the 400th anniversary celebrations in 1960 included a strong commitment to the democratic and egalitarian nature of Scottish Presbyterianism, and a residual sense that Roman Catholicism still remained a foreign religion. Romanism, indeed, was a term that continued to be used frequently. This is 1960, and we're still 2 years away from Vatican II. The principal of Aberdeen University, Sir Thomas Taylor, an elder of the Kirk, is also quoted in Life and Work from that year. If Scotland had fallen, England would have followed and the whole history of Europe would have changed. The Inquisition might have been found in the streets of Edinburgh. One man saved Scotland, John Knox. Now, if a principal of one of our ancient universities said that today, can you imagine the outcry? In the years prior to 1960, we should also recall that the Church of Scotland rejected the so-called Bishop's Report, which would have introduced bishops into presbyteries, thus paving the way for a union of the national churches of Scotland and of England. This episode requires further historical investigation, but it's clear that a decisive factor in the defeat of these proposals was the role played by the Scottish Daily Express, then the best-selling paper in the land. Arguing that bishops were an English and Erastian form of church government, fundamentally at odds with the more Scottish and egalitarian Presbyterian order, the Express persuaded many that the sacrifices of the reformers and covenanters had served the nation very well. These should not be overturned by a misplaced ecumenical enthusiasm for an alien form of church polity. Harry Reid has commented on this episode recently. Scottish Daily Express campaigned relentlessly on all sorts of issues, most famously after the Church of Scotland misguidedly proposed the introduction of bishops. The fury that McCall, its editor, egged on by Beaverbrook, its owner, in nightly phone calls, unleashed on the Kirk leaders behind the proposal, is still spoken of with awe 50 years on. This episode reveals two features of the articulation of Scottish identity in 1960. The first is that Scottishness is still closely associated with a form of Protestantism. The country continues to display a monolithic religious identity that reflects a national character that has evolved over several centuries. And second, this identity can be happily expressed within the United Kingdom. The Scottish Daily Express, of course, was a staunchly unionist newspaper, affirming a distinctive Scottish identity within the British nation. We might also recall that the last time the Conservative and Unionist Party held a majority of seats in Scotland was at the 1957 general election, the high watermark of Conservative politics, almost exactly coinciding with the peaking of Kirk membership at 1.32 million in the previous year, 1956. In the 1957 general election, the Conservative and Unionist Party secured 36 out of 71 seats in Scotland. So up until 1960, Scottishness is still associated with being Protestant, or more particularly Presbyterian, this taking place within the context of a commitment to the United Kingdom, itself a Protestant state. Let me move now to some historical soundings, going back to the Middle Ages and trying to trace this story forwards in a series of chronological leaps. Prior to the Reformation, we find ways in which Catholic Christianity reinforces a sense of Scottish identity. The Declaration of Arbroath in 1320 had fused religious and political aspirations by comparing Bruce with biblical figures such as Joshua or Judas Maccabeus, political leaders who had been raised by God to liberate their people. By this time, the Scottish Catholic Church was a distinct and semi-autonomous entity with its own diocesan and archiepiscopal structures. It was not governed by the Archbishop of York and was not therefore a province of the Church of England. In the 15th century, we find the temporal rule of the Scottish monarch aligned with the spiritual rule of the Scottish bishops and the Pope. This partnership of crown and church is apparent in the foundation of the three medieval universities in St Andrews, Glasgow and Aberdeen, Edinburgh, of course, being a modern civic upstart. Other features of Scottish religious identity in the Middle Ages included devotion to national saints such as Columba and Kentigern, Mungo, pilgrimages to their shrines. And so we find the notion that Scotland can in part be defined by its particular expression of Christianity long before the 16th century Reformation. John Knox does not show much interest in this history, but he does seem to assume in his own work and writings that there is already a Scottish church. This church is in part an expression of the identity of the nation, and his task and that of his associates is therefore to reform it. In some ways, the recent retrieval of Celtic Christianity might be seen as an attempt to recover an indigenous Scottish tradition that can be owned by both Catholics and Protestants. And much of the literature that has been spawned in recent years in Celtic Christianity is clearly animated by this idea. Despite questions about its historical provenance and distinctive theological identity, Celtic Christianity may still serve some ecumenical purpose in the celebration of Columba, missionary to Scotland, something we might talk about. Nevertheless, both before and after 1560, we should also bear in mind that there were other, more secular ways of constructing Scottish identity. Michael Lynch has pointed to the significance of the legal system in Scotland, practices such as that of map-making, the transmission of medieval epics of Wallace and Bruce, and the writing of Scottish history itself by medieval historians such as Hector Boyce, all these revealing multiple attempts to develop a sense of what it means to be Scottish. So apart from the church, there are other markers of Scottish identity. What about the Reformation? The Reformation itself is a complex phenomenon in relation to Scotland's national identity. In significant respects, it's a European and a British movement. John Knox had ministered to English exiles in Geneva. With his associates, he imported the theology of Bucer, Calvin, and Bullinger through the Scots Confession. The Protestant movement succeeded here against a Catholic monarch, in part through the support of the English crown. The Bible that was read in Scotland was the Geneva Bible, later the King James Bible, these being English, not Scots, translations of the Word of God. So the Reformation, somewhat ironically, contributed to the decline of Scots as a literary language. We might want to qualify that, however, by noting the later appearance of the Gaelic Bible, which does much to maintain Gaelic as a literary language in the 19th and 20th centuries, particularly in the Scottish Highlands. Again, something to talk about. But the Reformation is a somewhat complex phenomenon, being both Scottish, British, and European. My colleague Jane Dawson is writing a new biography of John Knox, and she says that you can claim John Knox for the causes of either unionism, independence, or Devo Max. Take your pick. He is a politically ambivalent figure who does not easily fit modern stereotypes. Nevertheless, as the Reformation proceeds in Scotland, we can discern the development of an identity that is both political and religious. This differentiates Scotland as a nation, covenanted nation, albeit within a united kingdom following the Union of Crowns in 1603. Professor Roger Mason, political theorist in St Andrews, has written this. In terms of imagining Scotland, one can say with some certainty that the fundamental objective of the Scottish Kirk was the creation of a godly commonwealth ruled by a godly prince in accordance with the law of God. This idea runs very deep in the political theology of the Covenanters in the 17th century. By virtue of the Reformation, Scotland is a covenanted nation which has entered into a pact with God. Or as some would prefer to say, Scotland has been singled out by God's providence to play a distinctive role amongst the nations. This determines all areas of national life, whether secular or religious. Equations of Scotland with Old Testament Israel are apparent in the writings of many leading Scottish divines of the 17th century. Samuel Rutherford writes in 1634, "Now, O Scotland, God be thanked, thy name is in the Bible." This vision of a godly commonwealth, covenanted nation, has been the cause of much celebration with respect to its ideals of comprehensive education, poor relief, and the accountability of political rulers to the law of God. This is apparent in the books of discipline and other foundational documents of the Reformation. But from our much later perspective, however, it can also be seen to generate several problems. First, there is the theological difficulty in reading Scotland as a new Israel. This political exceptionalism, it seems to me, is not warranted by Scripture. There is only one Israel chosen by God, and much of its history is characterized in any case by political failure and a very ambivalent reading of the authority of the earthly monarch. In the New Testament, we find little warrant for constructing the church as a political entity that takes its place alongside other empires, nations, and secular regimes. If anything, there is now a clearer differentiation of the secular and the religious. The church is an international movement that flourishes within a political order or political orders that are under the law of God. But it doesn't require a godly prince to legislate in favour of the church. Even more remote is the notion of a nation-state that is peculiarly blessed by God as a latter-day chosen people. To perceive one's own country as a new Israel, another covenant nation raised up in human history by God, is to risk distorting the significance of the only Israel and also of the church. Second and related difficulty with this idea concerns religious diversity. The vision of the godly commonwealth seems to assume that there is only one church in the realm to which all of its citizens belong. This is a feature shared with medieval Christendom. By virtue of birth, each child is baptized into the church and thereafter is under its discipline. Richard Hooker's celebrated remark that every member of the Commonwealth is a member of the Church of England, and every member of the Church of England a member of the Commonwealth, might equally well have applied to Scotland and its Kirk. Within this ideal of a nation defined by its unitary religious faith, there is little scope for dissent, diversity, or even a pluralism of Protestant groupings. It's significant, I believe, that two of the most powerful 17th century treatises written against the emerging ideal of religious tolerance were produced by Scottish divines, George Gillespie and Samuel Rutherford. Their opposition to diversity was animated by the conviction that a nation should aspire to ordering the totality of its life according to the Word of God. So while England witnessed the burgeoning of different groupings, sects and churches in the second half of the 17th century, Scotland retained a somewhat more unitary ecclesiastical culture as that century drew to a close. The 18th century, we've already spoken about the Scottish Enlightenment. In many ways, this is the golden age of Scottish Presbyterian identity within the Union. Supportive of patronage, the economic and cultural benefits of the Union, and the Protestant hegemony within the United Kingdom, the dominant moderate party within the Kirk could celebrate their dual identity as Scottish and British. The Scotland over which the Kirk presided in the first half of the 18th century has been described by Tom Devine as the parish state. National life was shaped by the aims of the Kirk, particularly with respect to poor relief, moral discipline, and education. Although their theology was markedly different from that of their covenanting grandparents, the moderates viewed the establishment of Protestantism and its Scottish variant as a mark of God's providence. The benefits of the Protestant establishment, the Union of 1707, and the advance of the British Empire are all celebrated by Scottish preachers throughout much of the 18th century. The leader of the moderate party, Principal William Robertson, here we see him in the famous Raeburn portrait, epitomises much of this era. Robertson is one of the three great British historians of the 18th century. And I like the way that that university mace is somehow cast aside as if the books are more important, and that's what he needs to return to. Robertson remains connected to the older theological traditions and practices that he is self-consciously revising, however. Affirming the moral and social cohesion created by religion, he's a strong supporter of the establishment of the Church of Scotland, while also in favour of extending greater toleration to Roman Catholics. The commitment to patronage, of course, is symptomatic of this interaction of religious and civil society. the moral texture of society is given close attention in moderate preaching, as it is in writers such as Adam Smith. Robertson himself being committed to a program of national virtue that is to be advanced by scholars, politicians, and preachers alike. The moderates are not, however, politically complacent or morally lax. Richard Scher has pointed to the way in which the rhetorical device of the Jeremiad is brilliantly adopted by moderate preachers such as Blair and Carlyle. With echoes of the covenanting sermons of the 17th century, they castigate their congregations for moral laxity, greed, and selfishness. Fast days are called at times of national crisis, especially during the American War of Independence. Their sermons urge repentance and a return to the ways of true religion throughout the land. Within this preaching, the Reformation discourse of Providence is again marked. There is a sense in which God has particularly blessed the people of Scotland and Britain, although this is combined with a lament about backsliding and a call for acts of penance and reform. Nevertheless, the cracks within this vision of a Scottish Presbyterian nation are increasingly apparent by the end of the 18th century. The secessions of that century had eroded the monopoly of the established church, as had the rise of independent and free churches. Callum Brown has estimated that by about 1800, around one-third of Scots were already adhering to other churches outside the national kirk. And this figure would rise dramatically after the disruption of 1843. One consequence of this much greater plurality was the decline of church discipline across the country. Kirk sessions could no longer regulate the behaviour of persons adhering to other churches. If you didn't like the discipline of your parish church, well, you could take yourself off elsewhere. The default assumption that everyone was subject to the discipline of the national church and its Kirk sessions no longer seemed plausible. With urbanisation and migration, the population of Scotland became more mobile and so less easy to monitor. Into the 19th and 20th centuries, the story is one of religious resurgence, with some belated attempts to reinvigorate the reformed notion of a godly commonwealth. The Victorian period is sometimes presented as an era of doubt and lost faith, but it's just as true to characterise it as a time of religious renewal. This is certainly true of the disruption, the rebellion of the pious against the system of patronage in the national church. Chalmers and his followers initially attempted to create a rival establishment, purer in form than the one from which they had seceded. But later their successors came to embrace voluntarist principles with enthusiasm, as did their counterparts in the UP church. At the same time, the Kirk gradually recovered its self-confidence through the work of leading figures such as Tulloch, Caird, Norman MacLeod, across the road at the Barony Kirk. Its worship was renewed according to more Catholic principles as a result of the influence of people such as Lee, Millikan, and Cooper. The late Victorian period is thus a time of some religious diversity as well as of enthusiasm and revival. Three large Presbyterian blocks emerged following the appearance of the United Presbyterian Church, and this Presbyterian proliferation accounts today for the multiplicity of church buildings in all our towns and cities. The congregation to which I belong at Green Bank in Edinburgh was the last new church to be founded by the UPs in 1900, before their union with the Free Church. The Scottish Episcopal Church also exhibited a renewed confidence at this time, embarking on an ambitious programme of church building. Immigrants arrived from Ireland to work in Scottish cities, their Catholic identity being preserved and nurtured by the increased presence of priests also from Ireland. If the Church of Scotland struggled to maintain its links with an urban working class, the same could not be said of the Roman Catholic Church. With the reunion of the Presbyterian churches in 1929, we find once again attempts to reassert the pan-Protestant identity of Scotland with the Kirk as its principal means of expression. The chief architect of the union was the formidable Dr. John White, another minister of the Barony Kirk nearby. Yet his achievements and reputation were tarnished by a series of intemperate attacks on Irish Catholics, whom he represented as racially and religiously alien to Scotland. He was not alone in this, as reports from the General Assembly in the 1920s make evident. Under White's leadership, the Church and Nation Committee in 1923 resolved to petition the government to restrict further immigration from the Irish Free State, and even to deport those Irish-born Catholics who received poor relief or held a prison record. White's biographer, Augustus Muir, makes not one reference to this episode, perhaps indicating that it had become an embarrassment to the Kirk by the middle of the 20th century. It was left to a man from Chicago, Professor Stuart Brown, to set the record straight on his arrival in Scotland in 1988. It is, I think, within this socio-historical context of the 1920s that we should read the Articles Declaratory of the Church of Scotland. These were recognised by Parliament in the Church of Scotland Act of 1921, Declaratory Article 3 being the most relevant in our context today. As a national church representative of the Christian faith of the Scottish people, it acknowledges its distinctive call and duty to bring the ordinances of religion to the people in every parish of Scotland through a territorial ministry. This declaratory article, I think, deserves some careful exegesis. You might think that the use of the indefinite article draws the sting from any claim that the Kirk is the national church. It's a national church. But it seems clear to me that this is exactly what is intended by the subsequent remark about bringing the ordinances of religion to the people, as opposed to any portion or subsection of the population. Recent readings of this text have attempted to revive it as expressing a worthy missionary reach to all the people of Scotland. This was the line taken by a report of a special commission to the General Assembly in 2009. Declaratory Article 3 teaches that no one is excluded from the mission of the Church. The Church of Scotland exists not just for its own members, but for all of Scottish society. Quite how this is received by our ecumenical partners, however, is not at all clear to me, and I'm not sure that the Kirk has properly asked them in any case. To suggest that this mission distinguishes the Kirk from other churches is dangerously hubristic. In 1921, the wording of Declaratory Article 3 seems to assume that Scotland is still a Protestant nation, and that therefore the Kirk has a duty to supply the ordinances of religion to its people. So the Kirk represents here not so much a mission to the whole people as the maintenance of an indigenous Protestant identity. This is still reflected many years later in the remarks of the Lord High Commissioner, the Prince of Wales, in the year 2000. I could not be more proud to stand before you this morning as Lord High Commissioner, because this office is a precious symbol of the long history which has bound together church and sovereign for nearly 450 years in a relationship of shared responsibility in their care for the people of Scotland. His speechwriters should have picked up the glaring error there, that the Church of Scotland did not begin in 1560. Nevertheless, the old vision of Scotland as an indigenous Protestant nation still seems to be in the background of remarks such as these. Despite the attempts of the General Assembly to maintain the notion that the Church of Scotland is the National Church of Scotland, I believe that we may do better to recognise that Declaratory Article 3 belongs to a very different historical context from our own. It is not one that is likely to be recovered in any foreseeable future, partly on account of secularism, partly on account of religious pluralism, and partly on account of ecumenism. We have actually always been a hybrid nation, ethnically, tribally, religiously, linguistically, and culturally. As Neil Asherson says in his book Stone Places, we are a mongrel nation, and we are likely to become increasingly hybrid in the future. The churches can provide some seasoning or leavening to this amorphous lump, but it should not seek to construct it in a way that is religiously monolithic. So we come to Scotland today, and here my thoughts become ever more unsystematic. The time has passed, I believe, when the Kirk, and this applies a fortiori to any other church, can speak for the people of Scotland as if it were the institutional expression of an indigenous religious identity. The future is better characterised as one in which the church must speak to the nation rather than for the nation. What we require is not so much a theology of Scottish nationhood as a public theology relevant to the socio-political context of contemporary Scotland. There are rich resources in our traditions which will assist with this task, but these will be better discriminated and released by forsaking outmoded notions of a Protestant nation. In some ways, this new setting may be experienced as liberating. For too long, we have had to put up with a negative stereotyping of Christianity, especially its Calvinist variant in Scotland. It's now time for a more balanced and judicious reception of the past. There is much of importance in Protestant social thought about the common weal, the significance of relationality in human affairs, the need for the public accountability of politicians, the ends of economic life, and the care of the poor and disadvantaged. These historical ingredients can all be part of a contemporary public theology that speaks to the nation rather than one that speaks for the nation. The millennium celebrations in the year 2000 took place shortly after the return of the Scottish Parliament. This raises some interesting questions about whether the Kirk is recognised by the Scottish Parliament in the same way as it is by Westminster. Its de jure status is probably unaltered by devolution, although independence would raise some interesting questions. But the de facto position of the Scottish Parliament since 1999 is that all faiths should be treated in an even-handed way without the privileging of any one group or body. We see this in the weekly moment of spiritual reflection at Holyrood and in the attempt to communicate and consult with ecumenical and interfaith bodies. In the run-up to the new Parliament, Johnson Mackay offered this comment, which I think has been proved largely true by subsequent events. It's clear that those preparing for a Scottish Parliament expect it to be even-handed, not only as between Christian denominations, but as between different faiths. In an ecumenical, multicultural Scotland, the traditional status of the Church of Scotland as a national church is irrelevant to the role which the communities of faith can play. Not very much has happened since 1999 to change that verdict, although we might note the ease with which the new Parliament has now adopted a regular service of kirking at St Giles, provided that it's seen as an ecumenical and multi-faith occasion. I did once inquire how this service of kirking had come about, who decided it and when, and I was told that Sir David Steele, as the first presiding officer, had bumped into Gillespie Macmillan in the High Street and had said, "We need to have a service, when can you arrange one?" So maybe tells us something about the pragmatism of Scottish politics, or else the old boy networks that continue to flourish in Edinburgh and elsewhere. Anyway, whatever we make of this, the current disposition of the Scottish Parliament represents not only the increasing diversity and secularism of modern Scotland, but also the conviction that Scottish identity is no longer articulated by ethnicity, race, or religion. If you live here, you count as Scottish, no matter where you're from or what you believe. This, I think, is reinforced by many of the significant social changes that have taken place since 1960. These have been described most vividly by Callum Brown in his 2001 study, The Death of Christian Britain. Secularism, he claims, is not so much a long, slow process lasting centuries. It's rather a sudden series of upheavals that has brought about a violent dissociation of church from society over a period of one or two generations. This is evident in the loss of Sunday as a day of rest, in the decline in baptisms and church marriages, the closure of many buildings as centres of worship, weekly church attendance falling to a figure of 7%, and the near total absence of young people in many of our congregations. With this, there is an accompanying loss of public significance, authority, visibility, and political salience. And the trend suggests that this is unlikely to change very much in the near future. What conclusions might we draw from all of this? Since 1960, we've also witnessed a resurgence of Scottish culture, this coinciding with the growth of Scottish nationalism. Professor Cairns Craig argues that devolution has come on the back of this movement to articulate a stronger sense of Scottish culture and national identity. These trends, however, have coincided almost exactly with the time of the church's decline, and this has ensured that very little attention has been devoted to religion in recent discussions of Scottish identity. In some ways, this might be welcomed. After all, it was never the burden of apostolic Christianity to represent ethnic or national identities. When it has become too closely aligned with nationalist movements, the church invariably faces the temptation of subordinating its claims and practices to more secular ends. National churches have too often blessed foreign wars of conquest and aggression. Released from the obligation to maintain a Protestant national identity across the whole territory of Scotland, the churches might find other forms of mission and ministry to be more effective. The churches have generally been more politically salient where their local presence is strongest and most influential. Without an earthed commitment to place and community, the church's voice lacks authenticity at a more national level. The local is the primary context for mission to a post-Christian society. The proclamation and enactment of the faith in ways that contribute positively to social capital, public well-being, and personal transformation. To this extent, the local enhancement of communities and ministries of word and sacrament, as noted earlier by Principal Burley in his 1960 address, continues to repay our attention. The church is where its people are. It does not derive its identity from a centralized office or a hierarchical structure. Salt of the Earth is a study of the social capital generated by faith communities in Glasgow, and it remains one of the most encouraging studies for churches today, suggesting that their influence may be much more significant than you would believe from the national media. Insofar as a renascent Scottish culture will continue to draw upon earlier resources, artistic, philosophical, literary, educational, and scientific, we might expect or hope that Scottish church history and theology will become increasingly important fields of study in Scotland tomorrow. if we can avoid either hypercriticism or slavish adherence to the formulations of the past, then we may find that these continue to contribute insights and resources for contemporary Scotland. Our intellectual elite today in Scotland is more interested, I think, in Scottish church history and theology than it was some 30 or 40 years ago. One area in which the study is badly needed is in the construction of a cultural Protestantism. Dangerous notion, I concede. But we need the construction of a cultural Protestantism that is more benign and positive than most of the constructions on offer today. Cultural Catholicism flourishes through the celebration of Irish folk culture, but Protestant analogues are much harder to find in contemporary Scotland. And this, I think, is a big problem for the anti-sectarian agenda. To undertake this task, we might need to look at Scottish language, literature, philosophy, and other traditions, both religious and secular, in an effort to see Protestant culture as more than the mere negation of the Catholic other. None of what I've argued here should suggest that faith is now to be relegated to a domain of private lifestyle choice. The churches remain the largest voluntary bodies in Scottish society, and they can continue to contribute to the formation of civic well-being, international cooperation, and good government. But they do so not alone and not as the state's exclusive partner. Their contribution takes place alongside other churches, faiths, and secular bodies, often with the need to form strategic alliances, to work alongside, and to learn from best practice elsewhere. That's as far as I got, and I'm glad to end there. Looking forward to your comments, questions, and subsequent discussion. Thank you all very much.
I'm sure you have questions or comments you'd like to present to us. Yes, Gordon.
Thank you. Professor Ferguson, I'm interested in your historical presentation there. What I'm hearing is a kind of monolithic understanding on the part of the Kirk as one body that represents the Christian faith in Scotland. And I'm guessing that the self-understanding would be that this is derived from divine authority. And I'm wanting to ask about setting that alongside the Union settlement in the 1920s and Marjorie MacLean's analysis, the Crown Rights, that something was granted by the Parliament to the Kirk. Now, if that analysis is correct, and 90 years on from that settlement, we're in a place where the identity of the Kirk has in some sense been granted by the state or the Parliament. How does that play out for Scottish identity and Scottish Christian identity in relation to the Kirk in a politically changing future?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly true that the settlement of 1921 represents a particularly Scottish and, if you like, reformed take on the relationship of church and state. So in the 1920s, the leaders or the architects of church union argued that, unlike the Church of England, the authority of the Church of Scotland in matters spiritual was not granted or gifted by the state. It was an authority that was, as it were, bottom-up. It was religiously or scripturally driven, and the most that the state could do was to acknowledge that authority, which is what the 1921 Act does. It doesn't confer upon the Church of Scotland a particular authority as a national church or a particular role as a national church. It simply recognises it. So it's difficult, I think, to say whether that makes the Church of Scotland established or disestablished. It's better just to say that there are different types of establishment in the United Kingdom. And it does leave open the possibility that the state might similarly acknowledge the existence of other churches. And that was certainly in the minds of the architects of church union, who hoped that there would be subsequent church unions, perhaps including the Scottish Episcopal Church, in the 20th century. My guess is that the Scottish Parliament is just not interested in that. And if we become an independent Scotland, we're not going to have an analogue of the 1921 Act, which acknowledges the identity of the Church of Scotland as a or the national church of the people. I think in a way it is declaratory Article 3 is anachronistic, and we should try to move on beyond that. Now, that's not to say that some of the reformed theology that informs its thinking about the relationship of church and state is not still valid. I think it is the kind of two kingdoms doctrine that is implicit in the Articles Declaratory is still relevant in marking out the different domains of church and state. That seems to me still to be something worth holding on to, the spiritual independence of the church, if you like.
Doug. Given that the rights and privileges of the Church of Scotland vis-a-vis the state are protected, as you said, by Westminster legislation rather than Edinburgh legislation, are you suggesting that to continue that position we should vote against independence?
I'm sure Alex Salmond would find a way around that. We're suddenly NATO is not such a bad idea after all, so maybe the Kirk as the national church might be okay if it gathers a few more votes for the referendum. I think we've moved on from 1921. I think that's really my point, and there's not much at stake here. I can't get very excited about declaratory Article 3, and similarly, I can't get very excited about debates surrounding establishment and disestablishment in England. I think what we have is a long evolving process, and we're better to be fairly relaxed about that particular evolution. I don't see that that there is any obvious scriptural or theological mandate for holding on to something like the 1921 Church of Scotland Act.
Well, unless you accept that church and state were both established by God in the Melville understanding of the establishment principle, so that, for example, at the moment it's very difficult for the state to take any action against a minister of the Church of Scotland preaching the gospel, whereas if the privileges were taken away, then, for example of a minister being fired by the church, what he did, he should have been fired. He tried to appeal to the Court of Session. Court of Session said no, the Church of Scotland General Assembly is the final court of appeal against which there is no appeal to the civil courts. Marjorie deals with that in her thesis. Now, that's only one example, but in the climate where increasingly equality laws are being used against Christian freedoms, I value whatever protection there is.
There are significant issues there, but I don't think the solution to these is to cling on to an anachronistic piece of legislation that appears to favour only one faith community. I don't think the state or our political society will, as it were, allow the Church of Scotland, say, an opt-out from European legislation or UK legislation, which it won't allow to other churches or faith groups. And I think it would be a mistake tactically to try to hold on to that. In any case, I think the Helen Percy case at the House of Lords has rather put us in a different position now. I don't think that the state will allow the courts of the church to trump its employment legislation. I don't even think the 1921 Act is doing that successfully anymore. The Church of Scotland is already having to look very closely at its own internal legislation about compulsory retirement age now. And again, I'd be very surprised if it was able to hold the line on that in a civil court. Now, we might deplore the intrusion of the civil courts into matters that are legitimate to the church courts only, but I think that will have to be dealt with and protected in a way that also extends such provisions to other churches and faith groups. Now, whether there could be some other act that might set that out, it's not clear to me, but there are quite a number of legal theorists who are sympathetic to the position of faith bodies and their confessional identities and think that these should be equally protected under European and human rights legislation. And I think that's probably the way to go on that one, but yeah, it is very complex. Doug's...
Partly is a comment on that as well, which is that in response to something that I moved to the General Assembly last year, there is a committee within the Church of Scotland examining the constitutional implications for the Church of Scotland of independence. And in terms of whether Westminster and the Treaty of Union offers more protection, I think some of the advice we've taken so far in that committee is suggesting that because the Treaty of Union had to be accepted by both parliaments and because, if you like, the place of the Church of Scotland had already been enshrined in legislation by the Scottish Parliament prior to the Union, that even if the Treaty of Union was set aside, there are other laws which would continue to make very similar provisions. So I think we're not wise to use that as an argument necessarily on its own to say that Westminster offered those protections. So that might be Alex Salmond's get out, if you like, in terms of what you're saying. The other thing I wanted to say was that there are already people drafting new model constitutions for Scotland, and while I agree with you that we are unlikely to get something like the 1921 Act produced, I think there is some urgency for theologians within Scotland that they attend to the question of what kind of recognition of religion and the churches they would like to see, if any, in a new constitution for Scotland. And I think that your voice should be one of the leading voices in this debate, David, because you've done so much work on this already, but this is a task very much for the present moment. And I think that the next 2 years... partly if the referendum is going to be in 2014, people will say, well, we need to know what we're deciding on. And so I think we will see a lot of activity around constitutional drafting. And I think we have to be present in those debates. And that's going to maybe need to push beyond what you've been saying about simply saying, well, we're not going to get the 1921 Act again, to say, what positively would we like to see? And are we relaxed about a completely secular constitution?
Yeah, I think that's a very helpful comment. I'm sure that, well, whether we remain in the UK or become an independent Scotland, we are going to face, we may already be facing, the kind of questions that the French have dealt with. What do we say about the wearing of religious symbols in public places, for example? And it, certainly if we become independent, there will need to be a Scottish solution to that, or at least an attempted solution. I take your point. It's something we need to be discussing now. I don't know if anyone is. I should ask my colleagues in the law faculty whether they've looked at this. But
yes, Roger.
Can I ask a question about even-handedness? I've just come back from two Asian societies, and as I look at social statistics, the 201 census suggests that in both Scotland and the UK, between 71 and 72% of the population describe themselves as Christian, and that the minority faiths are actually very, very small at a national level, something like 3 to 6%, depending how you count, especially in Scotland. In that context, do you really think to say that we treat all faiths in a certain way is even-handed? I feel I'm coming into society with projected or hypothetical multiculturalism rather than a totally socially balanced multiculturalism. And I say that because Malaysia's statistics for Islam would be 61%. Mm-hmm. And in other words, the social statistics of the UK in the last census, the next one won't be published until 2012, I think it was 2013, is quite different from our sort of public perception of it, allowing things like the 7% church attendance. But no one says in Malaysia, you know, how many women go to the mosque, or in Thailand, how many people go to the temple. The 90% or whatever will stand the respect of those sorts of figures. I just wondered, are we really as even-handed as we think we are?
It's true that Scotland is much more ethnically monochrome than most other European societies. And while I think the next census will reveal a significant drop in the number of people self-identifying as Christian, it will still be, I guess, above 50%, whereas the Muslim population in Scotland is, 1.5% maybe? I don't know, something of that order. So we don't look as religiously diverse as say, France or England, for that matter. I think, however, what we will find increasingly in Scotland is a commitment to some ideal of pluralism, a willingness to treat people of different faiths and none on an equal basis. Now, what that means when it's cashed out is much less clear. I mean, does Christmas Day remain a public holiday, for example? The signs at the moment are that it will remain so, but that Good Friday and Easter Monday will not be public holidays, although we haven't had the same tradition of religious holidays in Scotland as in England. I mean, I get very uneasy, I have to say, when I hear Cardinal O'Brien shouting about the persecution of Christians in our society today, as if somehow there's a militant secularism that's out to get us and to do us down. I think that's to over-dramatise and exaggerate our current situation. And given the history of Scotland, in which there has been this Presbyterian hegemony, it's maybe not surprising that we see examples of a counter reaction. I think much more comparative work would probably be good for us. Let's look at what's going on elsewhere in the world. Your Malaysian comparison is an instructive one. What's happening in Europe elsewhere? How does Scotland learn from best practice mistakes that other people have made? the notion of a pluralist, multi-faith society is not a simple or univocal one. There are many different constructions of what that means. Sorry, I'm not getting much further than that.
I take your point that, you know, we have to go beyond 1921. But at the same time, I'm a bit nervous that we're being sucked in to really, in the churches, accepting a secular state.
Yes.
And I wonder whether, as I think what I heard Doug say, is that we need to sort of rearticulate the two kingdoms, as you yourself referred to, in the new context. Because I think we're going to find, you know, that the Muslims are not so strong in Scotland, but they are much stronger in England and in France, for example. There's going to be, I think, an increasing Muslim lobby for a theocratic state. Now, are we going to respond to that by opting for secularism or a secularized state?
Mm-hmm.
Is there not something in our Christian heritage here in Scotland which is worth recontextualizing and rearticulating?
I mean, I guess I would respond to that in maybe in two ways. The first is that my sense is that other faith groups are actually more comfortable with the establishment of the Church of England or the Church of Scotland than they are with a secular state. They're more fearful of a militant secularism than they are of the Christian churches, which they find generally very hospitable. Second, I think there will continue to be an important place for the churches, both locally and nationally, in terms of marking rites of passage in representing the country on important civic occasions. That will continue to be requested of the churches. But I think it's a mistake, probably, on the part of the churches to insist upon that as somehow a right because of our history in this country. I think that will simply produce a reaction in a more secular direction. That's certainly my experience of life within the university. There's still, in some sense, a desire for the church to have its place and to host important events, but as soon as you become too defensive and insistent upon that, people begin to get nervous and fearful. So it may be in some respects a tactical issue as much as an ideological one. I think the example of the kirking of the Parliament is very interesting. I mean, nobody in the churches stood up and demanded that, saying we're a Christian country and therefore we must have a kirking of the Parliament in one of our churches. But it was requested by the Parliament and it happened, and it's now part of our tradition.
But do you think there is a case for rearticulating our theology of the state in the light of the new, situation, new context that we find ourselves in? Is there something in our heritage that we're in danger of losing?
I think there is in this sense that, I mean, if we're a post-Christian society, then we're not a pre-Christian or a non-Christian or a pagan or an Islamic or something else society. Christian is still part of the predicate that identifies our society, even if that is post-Christian, and one would expect the churches, even in a post-Christian society, to have a significant civil role. But I think that will have to be quite carefully negotiated.
I'm afraid we'll need to end it there. David, when we invited you to speak on this topic, we knew it would be a high-quality and insightful presentation, and in spite of your cheap shot toward the chair at the beginning of your talk, you exceeded our expectations very much. So let's show our appreciation. We have about a half an hour for some tea and coffee before the